by what to her was a change of subject, Daisy said, "Woman?"
"Mrs. Gray's friend. For all we know, she may be visiting anywhere in the country. Or out of it."
"You're not going to follow her to the continent?"
"No. If I get an address for her, I'll send a wire. If not, I'll have to ask the Sirette to trace her."
"Unless she's gone to Italy?"
"I'll cross that bridge, if and when."
"Could you drop me at home? It's not too far out of your way to Whitehall. If the rain holds off, I'll take the twins and Nana for a walk. If not, I'll tackle my account book. And I'll bring back the article I started writing before I fell ill. I ought to try to get some work done." Far from attempting again to persuade her to stay at home, as she expected, he said,
"If you want to bring your portable typewriter, get a taxi to Marylebone. And don't carry it from the Beaconsfield station up that steep approach. Leave it there, and I'll pick it up when I get back."
"Thank you, darling. I hope you don't have to go herring off to Scotland because the mysterious friend has joined a shooting party."
"Judging by what I've learned of Mrs. Gray, no intimate friend of hers would be a sporting type."
"Even the unsporting can get inveigled into a country house visit that involves shooting. You're right, though. She's more likely to be on the Riviera."
"Lucky her. If you've finished, you'd better go and get your coat."
"I must write a note to Isabel to let her know I'll be back. I hope she's managing to find someone willing to clean." Alec had only once before called on Eric Bragg at the Foreign Office. Bragg had since been promoted. He was now Private Secretary to the Deputy Secretary to the Permanent Undersecretary, or something of the sort. He was vague about his exact rank. He had even acquired a secretary of his own, a spruce, alert young woman, and an office that retained some of its Victorian grandeur. He was the same scruffy, wild-haired chap Alec had first met at university in Manchester. The son of a couple of Lancashire cotton mill workers, he had inherited the determination that had enabled them to survive childhood labour in the dark, satanic mills and move up to owning a corner shop in the city. In Eric's case, he had made good use of the help of a teacher who recognised his abilities. He had won a scholarship to Manchester Grammar, where his affinity for languages, from classical Greek and Latin to modern French and German, emerged. A second full scholarship to the Victoria University of Manchester added several more languages to his repertoire. That was sufficient to overcome the FO's built-in bias toward Oxford and Cambridge graduates. Bragg started as a lowly translator, acquired a fair understanding of another couple of dozen languages, and made himself indispensable, despite his humble background, farouche appearance, and ineradicable Mancunian accent.
"Robert Gray," he said now.
"Yep, I do know Bob."
"You do? I didn't expect that."
"He's a colleague. And a friend. When he's home, we work together. Do a bit of fencing. Go out together for a pint, now and then. He can speak colloquially more languages than I can read. No degree. He's a rolling stone, and he picks up the lingo like a native, wherever he goes."
"Which is what I'm interested in. Where he goes, or rather, where he's been. I hoped you could get the information I need from whoever would have it. But perhaps you already know his movements."
"No one knows Bob's movements. He's sort of extracurricular."
"A spy?"
"A seeker of information, like you. What are these inquiries of yours about? I don't see how he can be in serious trouble. In this country, he doesn't spend enough time here, especially since his father remarried. It is an official criminal case, I presume."
"Sort of extracurricular," But that's beside the point. It's a murder case. The victim is Robert Gray's stepmother.
Oh, Lord.
You said he has avoided England since his father married her.
Yes. He referred to her as the witch.
Sometimes with a different initial letter, depending on the company. When he was in England on leave, he'd meet his father in town, rather than risk coming face to face with her.
Why did he so dislike her?
He never really talked about her, just the odd mention. The usual thing, I suppose. She was on the hunt for a wealthy husband, and old Grey was the sap she got her claws into.
If she made him happy.
Do you know, I'd swear Bob never talked about his stepma, but I definitely have the impression that she made his pa very unhappy.
Don't quote me on that.
I won't, but it adds to the opinions we've heard from others. When did you last see Robert Gray? You know his father died in April.
April, was it?
Bob turned up in June, a couple of months later. He'd been in, well, I better not say, even to a high-up copper. It was several weeks before the news reached him, and it took him several weeks to get home.
You saw him then?
Oh, yes. He was in and out of the office for a fortnight or so, though he came back only to see his lawyer.
Damn. I knew there was something else we should have asked Ainsley.
Lawyers have a way of getting rid of unwelcome visitors.
If Ainsley's in Beaconsfield, Bob didn't see him. He communicated through his own lawyer, here in town.
But he was in England for a couple of weeks in June. You're certain he left the country afterwards?
Absolutely certain. He sent in a dispatch via the British consul in, somewhere in the Middle East, in September. It's stated in his own atrocious handwriting, and the date of the consul's seal is 2 days later. I can't remember exactly. I can find out for you. Of course, that doesn't mean he couldn't be back in England by now. In fact, he is. But he came home with one of those eye conditions common in that part of the world. To my knowledge, he's been under a doctor's care with his eyes bandaged for the past 10 days.
You could have told me right away.
Bragg grinned. I could have. Just prolonging the pleasure of your company, mate. You see, though, he couldn't have done in the witch.
That rather depends, doesn't it, on when the witch was killed.
Oho, so that's it. Not in the last 10 days, I take it. When?
We can't be sure of the exact date. Be a good chap and get me the date when he wrote that dispatch.
All right. But I'll have to go and beg on bended knee. Coffee?
Is it any good?
Oh, yes. None of your police canteen muck for us. I'll be back shortly.
He sauntered out. Alec, remembering him as a brisk mover, assumed he was aping the languid manners of the well-bred young men whose families had pushed them into the F.O. for want of anything better to do with them. The rattle of the typewriter in the outer room stopped, and Alec heard his friend ask his secretary to bring coffee for two. He addressed her as Chuck, not what she would be accustomed to from those languid young men. The Mancunian endearment didn't hold any significance. Bragg addressed thus any female less than a decade older than he was, and the secretary was about Daisy's age. She brought in a tray with two cups of coffee and a plate of Marie biscuits. Having set it on the desk, she lingered.
I hope Mr. Bragg isn't going to be too long. His coffee will get cold, as usual.
As usual.
He gets so wrapped up in his work, he often doesn't even notice I've brought it. He'd never eat any lunch either, if I didn't remind him.
How long have you worked for him?
Since May. He's such a hard worker. He keeps me busy. But that's better than being bored. And lots of what I type is pretty interesting. Top secret, of course.
I'm not allowed to talk about it at all. Not to anyone. Have you known Mr. Bragg a long time?
About 20 years.
She nodded. I thought you must be an old friend. All the same, it's lucky you arrived first thing. He never sees anyone without an appointment, even his boss. He says interruptions pull him out of whatever language he's translating, and then he wastes time switching back from thinking in English. Part of my job is keeping people out. Well, I'd better get back to work. I'm sure he won't keep you waiting, sir. Alec was less sure, given Bragg's mention of begging on bended knee. Often a lengthy process. However, he needed the information. It was worth waiting a few minutes, in the hopes of crossing a suspect off the list, especially the suspect with by far the best motive. He wondered how Underwood and Ernie Piper were getting on, and whether Tom had come up with anything of interest. Bragg returned to cold, scummed coffee, as predicted. He pushed it aside without appearing to notice it, and sat down.
"The 6th of September," he announced.
"How does that fit in with your murder?"
"Damn. I'll have to check travel times, but I'd say it leaves the question open. Depends exactly where the dispatch came from, of course."
"Which I can't tell you.
And damn again. Would you tell me if it meant saving Gray from the hangman?"
"Ask me again if you're about to arrest him."
"I shall. How is he, apart from his eyes? Not suffering from a raging, or raving fever, I trust?"
"Not when I call to see him. Are you going to talk to him?"
"Of course. He's the closest relative, if only by marriage, to a murder victim. In fact, the only relative we're aware of. If there are others, he may be able to direct us to them. In any case, on her death, he becomes a wealthy man."
"He never mentioned that."
"Did he know?" "So his father's lawyer says."
Bragg was silent for a moment, then sighed.
"All right, I see your point. At least tell me you have other suspects."
"A couple, but none with half as good a reason for wanting the woman dead as Robert Gray."
23. Gray's flat was in a large Edwardian red brick block on Marylebone Road. Its many numbered entrances were set back between pairs of bay windows, rising the height of the first three stories. By the looks of the place, Albert hadn't stinted his son in the matter of accommodation. As he climbed the stairs, Alec reflected that dates and the distance travelled didn't tell the whole story. It was unlikely that Gray should have somehow found out that his stepmother was moving, and therefore might not be missed for some time, unless the lawyer, Ainsley, had written to him. Another question to put to the irritable little man. Even then, to travel all that way hoping that Judith Gray was still in Beaconsfield was to draw the bow at a very long shot. Yet the man was a spy, presumably used to improvising on the spur of the moment and to taking chances for far less personal reward than a sizable fortune. If circumstances did not conspire to favour him, he might have reckoned to be able to trace Judith and rid himself of her in her new abode. Alec reached the third floor. The passage leading back into the depths of the building was ill-lit, narrow, but carpeted and clean. Several doors opened onto it, each bearing a letter. He found Gray's and pressed the electric bell. Nothing happened. He waited a minute, then rang again. This time, he heard a male voice within calling, though he couldn't make out the words. Again he waited. No footsteps, but his patience was rewarded by the click of the Chubb lock. The door opened to reveal a diminutive cleaning lady in carpet slippers and a flowery overall.
Was you wanting Mr. Gray?
Yes, please. I'd like a word with him. Would you give him my card, madam?
Oh, madam, is it?
I'll give him your card, but it won't do him a lot of good, seeing he's got a bandage over his eyes.
Perhaps you could read it to him.
I got me glasses, didn't I?
Tell him I'm a police officer. Who is it, Mrs. D?
A Rosa, sir, she called back. Leastways, so he says. But he ain't wearing no uniform.
Even without his uniform, I dare say he'll relieve the tedium. Show him in.
The voice was educated, though not, Alec thought, at the best schools. Gray and Eric Bragg must have been drawn to each other, because neither sported a public school tie or accent. Mrs. D, stepped back, and Alec followed her over the threshold. On his right, a door stood open to a pleasant, masculine sitting room, well lit by the tall bay windows. The charwoman led him the other way, down a corridor even narrower than that at the stair top, its left wall being shared with the common passage beyond. A comfortable flat, but not extensive. The next door was ajar. She tapped and pushed it open.
Here he is, sir.
The room was darkened, illuminated only by a lamp concealed behind a folding screen, and what little light came from the corridor. Alec made out a bed against the far wall, with a man's figure lying on his back on the top of the counterpane. His upper face was hidden by a folded napkin.
Mr. Robert Gray.
That's me. You're the Rosa, I take it?
Detective Chief Inspector Fletcher. May I come in?
Please. You'll excuse me for not getting up. Doctor's orders. Find a seat and tell me what a high-up copper wants with me. I'm already intrigued. It's as boring as hell. Don't you think hell must be the ultimate eternal boredom? None of those raging fires.
It's certainly a possibility, if you believe in hell.
Not really, Gray admitted. All the same, the tedium is driving me mad. I have to lie here for a couple of hours twice a day with this damn lotion-soaked cloth swathing my eyes, and I'm not allowed out of the flat at all, for fear of getting grit in the irritable orbs.
What's the trouble?
Coretto conjunctivitis. Aren't you sorry you asked? It's quite a common ailment in the Middle East. Dry air and blowing sand. I suppose you know I've been in the Middle East.
Eric Bragg told me.
Eric?
He didn't specify where.
Then neither shall I. Is this an interrogation?
I have some questions I'd like to put to you. You're at liberty to refuse to answer, though your refusal will be noted and may...
And may be used in evidence against me.
He sounded amused.
What am I supposed to have done? Not a traffic accident, I assume.
Rather more serious. Before I explain, would you mind telling me when you reached England?
About 10 days ago. The 5th, I think. I was rushed straight to the hospital for tropical diseases, in case my eyes were infectious, which, I'm thankful to say, they're not.
Was your passport stamped?
I've no idea. At that point, I couldn't see at all. My eyes were bandaged very thoroughly whenever there was the slightest chance of light reaching them.
How did you manage?
I can't tell you how I reached a consulate in a port city. Nor which city, come to that. But they had someone help me aboard, and then the steward took good care of me. The purser had one of the crew deliver me to the passport people, who sent me to the hospital.
We'll check with the hospital.
I wasn't travelling under my own name. Grey said dryly. As I arrived under the auspices of a passport official, I was admitted...
Alec sighed.
I suppose in your profession you have several passports.
The man on the bed grinned. An odd sight, with the cloth hiding the rest of his face.
And they've all been turned into the F.O. pending my next assignment.
Abandoning that line of questioning as unprofitable, after all, he didn't really need to know about Grey's most recent arrival, Alec asked,
And your previous trip home, when was that?
The spy's mouth hardened.
June. As soon as I heard of my father's death in April. I still can't believe your lot didn't think there was anything fishy about it.
Our lot asked for an inquest, even though Albert Grey's doctor said he died of a heart attack that was not unexpected in view of his health. The coroner's jury ruled his death natural. In the light of the verdict, the police had no grounds on which to proceed. What grounds have you for suspicion?
What grounds had the police for requesting an inquest? He parried.
Nothing but gossip. The better safe than sorry principle. People were saying Mrs. Grey fed him arsenic. That always resounds in the public's imagination. But there were no symptoms of arsenic poisoning, and no significant trace in the body. He had a weak heart. You knew that?
Yes. He was taking some sort of pills that kept it beating.
The other prevalent rumour was that she'd substituted dummy pills. Difficult, if not impossible, to prove.
It didn't take rumour to make me suspicious. The bitch he married led him a dog's life.
The pun was unintentional, Alec thought. Certainly not intended to amuse.
Why did he marry her?
He missed my mother. They'd hardly been apart for a day all their lives. Even as children, they'd grown up in the same street. And he was lonely. I was away too much.
Your stepmother was very much his junior.
But reaching the age when she'd begin to be regarded as a spinster... Not a bright young thing.
His voice was full of scorn.
She was too desperate for a husband, to be particular. Except where money was concerned. She wouldn't have married a poor man.
She had expensive tastes, had my stepmama.
So I've heard.
Grey's grimace was wolfish.
What she hadn't realised was that Dad grew up quite poor. And he regarded extravagance as a sin. He didn't stint on clothes or housekeeping, but he refused to dissipate what he'd worked so hard for to buy useless baubles or expensive cars, let alone to throw house parties for people he didn't even like.
You disliked and despised her.
From the moment we met. That was several months after the wedding, because I'd been out of touch. She cajoled him into tying the knot as soon as possible, though Dad said he wanted to wait for my return. I could have saved him if I'd been here.
I doubt it. Or if you had somehow prevented the marriage, he would always have resented your interference. You remained on good terms.
Oh, yes. He was still infatuated with her, but it was too late to open his eyes. So I was polite to her in his presence.
What made you dislike her instantly?
I suppose it was her manner towards him, Grey said slowly. There was nothing I could pin down. I tried to persuade myself it was the instinctive mistrust that's essential to my job. Yours too, I would imagine. Then I overheard her talking to a friend about my father, and that dispelled all doubt. She despised him, and I hated her.
So you ceased to be polite?
I ceased to meet her. Dad came here, or we went to my club.
He was completely disillusioned by the next time I was in England. Why am I blabbing to you?
To deflect suspicion? Or because he didn't know Judith was dead?
You tell me.
Grey was silent for a moment.
I haven't been able to talk about it to anyone else. No one else has shown any interest, of course. Maybe some of his friends in Beaconsfield cared, but I don't know them. My parents moved there long after I'd left home.
He paused.
Partly it's because I can't see you. Damn my eyes.
When can you take the bandage off?
Permanently. A couple more weeks at least, the doctor expects. Depends on progress, which is why I obey orders. This session, you tell me. I set the alarm for 11:30.
He gestured at the clock on the bedside table.
Should be soon, but it always feels like forever.
Just a couple of minutes.
Alec wanted to see the man's whole face. In general, the eyes were far less capable of concealing emotion than the mouth.
The hell with it!
He sat up, taking off the cloth, and dropping it with a slight splash in a basin beside the clock. His eyes were reddish, half open. He blinked and raised his hands with forefingers crooked, then froze.
Damn! It's so hard not to rub them. Make me think about something else. Why are you interested in my father's second marriage anyway?
Through slitted eyes, he stared at Alec.
Your father's second wife is dead.
Grey's eyes opened fractionally wider.
Dead? Good riddance. But she was my age, a year or two younger. What did she die of? Motor smash?
Wait a minute.
You came to bring me the news. A detective chief inspector, didn't you say? She was murdered, and you presume I did it.
I don't presume you did it. I have to consider the possibility. You have a very strong motive. Are you aware of how your father left his affairs?
He told me he felt obliged to provide for his widow, if that's what you mean. He apologized, poor old chap. But everything was to come to me if she remarried or died. At the time, the former seemed far more likely.
Did the solicitor, Mr. Ainsley, write to tell you Mrs. Grey proposed to sell the house, Cherry Trees, and did in fact do so?
He may have. My letters are held for me when I'm abroad, and I haven't been able to read anything since I got back. It doesn't surprise me, though. She was never cut out for life in a village. I expect she's bought a flat in town.
Alec chose not to enlighten him.
You don't mind.
Grey shrugged.
As I mentioned, I didn't grow up in that house, and I haven't even visited in years. I have no emotional attachment. I do see what you mean about motive, though. I assure you, I've been unable to leave the flat since I was discharged from the hospital. I'll give you my doctor's name.
Thank you. That won't be necessary. You see, she died a month ago.
A month? Mid-September. I was a long way from England, and a long camel ride from the nearest port.
I've heard camels aren't the easiest ride in the world.
They're not, particularly when you can't see.
The alarm clock rang shrilly. Alec took it as his cue to leave. He returned to Whitehall, but not to the Foreign Office. They weren't going to give him an answer unless he called in the heavy guns. The question was, in view of his unofficial status in the case, would the super cooperate? Several colleagues greeted him on his way up to Crane's office. Word of his present situation had spread, inevitably. Some were inquisitive. Some teased him about his penchant for odd cases. Only a couple knew about Daisy's frequent involvement,
and they were too discreet to mention her. Superintendent Crane was fatalistic.
As soon as I heard Mrs. Fletcher was involved, I knew there'd be complications.
Sir, you can't blame my wife for the Foreign Office's reluctance to divulge where one of their secret agents spent September.
When you put it like that, but I bet she has relatives in the F.O.
A cousin, on her mother's side. Would you like me to appeal to him for assistance?
Heaven forbid! I'll see what I can do. What's the man's name again?
Robert Gray, sir. The victim's stepson.
Ah, yes. Difficult relationship. Not that I mean to suggest. How are the children doing these days, Fletcher?
Alec assured him that Belinda loved her boarding school, and the twins were growing by leaps and bounds.
Good, good. I'll be in touch when I get the information. Or not, as the case may be. Never can tell with those Foreign Office johnnies.
Alec made his way to Belgravia. Judith Gray's friend, Elizabeth Knox, lived in a fashionable masonette, in a row of fashionable masonettes, with pretentious columned entrances. All the curtains were closed. He rang the bell. Again, an overalled cleaning woman opened the door. "Not at home," she said, and started to shut it.
"Just a minute."
She stopped and fixed him with an incurious gaze.
"Nobody's home, like what I said."
He lifted his hat.
"Is Miss Knox out for the day?"
he asked hopefully.
"Missus. They've both gone off."
"When will they be back?"
"Dunno."
"Can you tell me where they went?"
"Dunno. They don't tell me, do they? I comes in 3 days a week like always. Don't make no odds to me, saving there's more work when they're home."
"They must leave a forwarding address with someone."
"Dunno. If that's all, I've got me work to do."
The door started to close again, and Alec found no reason to arrest its progress. Where, oh where, were all the inquisitive, garrulous charwomen of England hiding? 24. The twins were rolling down the hill. Though the sun shone, it had rained in the night. Miranda's pinny and Oliver's corduroy rompers were covered with mud. Daisy decided she'd better add a tip when she paid the laundryman's bill. Nana was pretty muddy too. Luckily, it was the gardener's day, so he could wash her. Elsie would do it if necessary, but she didn't consider it any part of a parlourmaid's duties. And of course, she was quite right. A less obliging girl would refuse.
"One more time, my pets,"
Daisy called, as the children toiled up towards her again.
"Then we must go home. Don't pout, Miranda. The wind will change and your face will get stuck. What would Nanny say?"
The dog suddenly charged up the hill, barking.
"Daddy!"
Oliver shouted, his short legs pumping harder. Daisy turned to see Alec coming down. He fended off Nana, who danced about him, whining her delight. He might as well not have bothered, as he then swept up Oliver in his arms, transferring a goodly quantity of mud to his jacket, and placed him, shrieking with joy, on his shoulders. Miranda arrived. Alec bent to pick her up, eliciting further shrieks from Oliver, but she said,
"No, Daddy, I'm being a lady. I'll hold your hand like Mummy does. Mummy, you can have his other hand."
"Thank you," said Daisy, laughing at the muddy little lady as she took advantage of her generosity. Oliver piggyback, Daisy and Alec walking slowly to allow for Miranda's short stride. They turned homeward. The children chatted about the fun they'd had. Oliver's speech was still unclear, but his sister understood every word and interpreted when necessary. Back at the house, they went off with Bertha, the nursery maid, happily repeating their story, which doubtless would be told a third time to Nanny Gilpin. Mrs. Gilpin wouldn't scold them too much for their condition, knowing perfectly well who was to blame. "You'll have to change everything you're wearing, Alec," said Daisy, following the twins and Bertha up the stairs. "Oliver even got his grubby little hands on your collar."
"Your skirt isn't exactly what I'd call pristine."
Daisy glanced down and laughed. Mrs. Dobson had lunch waiting when they came down. Alec was in a hurry to get back to Beaconsfield, so they didn't linger over the meal. He carried her Remington portable typewriter out to the car, and they set off. "Did you talk to Mr. Bragg this morning?" Daisy asked. "How is he?"
"Flourishing. It turns out Robert Gray is a friend of his."
"So he was able to tell you all about him?" Alec shook his head.
"Not much more than he's in England. His travels are strictly hush-hush."
"He's a secret agent?"
"I didn't say so."
"No, but really, darling, a hush-hush diplomat can hardly be anything else. So they wouldn't tell you where he was when?"
"I've had to put the super onto it,"
Alec said gloomily. "I suppose he thinks it's all my fault."
"Not exactly your fault. Just, if you weren't involved in the case, the situation wouldn't have arisen. He doesn't really believe it, of course."
Daisy snorted in a most unladylike manner. "I should be used to him by now. He's going to find out about the spy for you, is he?"
"He's going to ask. Whether he'll get an answer remains to be seen. Gray is in England at present, and having talked to him, I'm inclined to doubt that he killed his stepmother."
"You're always telling me that my personal belief in someone's innocence is of no significance, especially if it's someone I like. Did you like Robert?"
"I didn't dislike him. He's a quirky chap. Interesting."
"And obviously plausible. A prime requirement for a spy must be plausibility." Alec laughed.
"He didn't strike me as a plausible liar, but you're probably right."
"Is he willing to identify the body?"
"I didn't ask. The doctor who did the autopsy said it would be impossible to make her face presentable. Sorry, I shouldn't have told you that. You're not going to be sick, are you?"
He slowed down, prepared to stop. "No, I'm all right. I just need to shut down my imagination."
"Sure."
"Sure."
"In any case, Gray came home with a serious eye complaint."
"Oh, poor man. What about the woman, Mrs. Gray's friend?"
"Departed, for parts unknown. The Daily professed to be unaware of her destination, and it wasn't the sort of neighbourhood where women chat on the doorsteps. A bobby or two making house-to-house inquiries might turn up something. It's up to Underwood to decide whether he wants to request that level of assistance from the Met."
"Beneath the dignity of a detective chief inspector?"
"Very much so. Not to mention a waste of my time."
Messages awaited both Daisy and Alec at the Saracen's Head. "Oh, good," said Daisy, reading hers. "Isabel managed to hire a couple of men to clean the cellar. She's over at the house now, supervising, from a distance, and doing some gardening. I think I'll walk over to see how it's going. What about you?"
"Underwood has finished his inquiries in High Wycombe for the moment. He suggests I join him and Piper at the police station."
"Here or in Wycombe?"
"Here. To discuss our various findings and plan the next moves. I'll see you later, love."
expect you when I see you? All right. I hope the inspector had more luck this morning than you did. Alec had covered half the short distance to the police station when it started to rain. Thinking about the case, he hadn't noticed the increasingly threatening clouds. He almost turned back to tell Daisy not to go to Cherry Trees, to remember she'd been ill. Whatever he said, she'd make her own decision, though. Glancing back, he saw her red umbrella bobbing as she walked in the opposite direction. With any luck, he thought with a sigh, the cellar would have been cleaned already, to the point where she and Isabel could take refuge in the house. He found Underwood dictating his report to Ernie, who had studied shorthand before becoming a detective officer, with the aim of attaining that branch of the service. Pennycook was laboriously writing his own report longhand. They all looked up as Alec entered, Pennycook with an air of profound relief.
"Any news?" Underwood asked.
Alec told them the indecisive results of his morning's travails. The inspector grunted.
"Good job we don't want him to take a look at her face. Nor the friend, neither, if she wasn't traipsing about on the other side of the channel, in any case."
"How about you, Mr. Underwood? Any luck? What about the rings?"
Underwood gestured at Ernie, who said, "Mr. Ainslie recognised the fake ruby right away as Mrs. Gray's. Not a doubt in his mind."
"Thank goodness."
"While I was there, I asked him about the stepson, whether he'd come back after his father's death. I didn't know you were going to see him yourself, Chief."
"He did come back to England in June. I didn't ask him whether he'd come down to Beaconsfield. I slipped up there, though Bragg said all communication about the will was through Gray's own London solicitor."
"That agrees with what Mr. Ainslie said," Ernie confirmed.
"I can't see it matters, Mr. Fletcher," said Underwood, "because he told you he thought his father's death suspicious, even without hearing local rumours. I reckon he still got the best motive by a mile and a half."
"So it still comes down to what the FO will reveal about his whereabouts. Let's hear the rest of your news, Inspector."
"I'll start with the last item, so that Sergeant Piper can finish taking down my report. In official language, please, Mr. Piper. I called on the rector, the Reverend Jeremy Turnbull, regarding inquiries about Cartwright. He told me he'd spoken to three young women, quite independently of each other. All had been approached with lascivious intent, including physical contact. His words, by Roger Cartwright, the headmaster of the church school."
"My wife," said Alec.
Damn, he'd meant to keep Daisy out of this particular business.
"My wife knows, of course."
"So she was your source?"
Underwood perked up.
"I wondered. I asked Mr. Turnbull whether Miss Layton was one of the three, but he refused to answer."
"So does Daisy. Given Miss Layton's upset nerves and the rector's involvement, we can be pretty sure of her. I'd guess the others were her predecessors at the school. We can find them if we need them. Is the rector taking any action?"
"He's spoken to the governor of the school board, who'll be calling a meeting of the trustees."
"We ought to interview Cartwright before that, if possible."
"Yes. I'll let D.S. Piper tell you the rest of our news while I ring up my super about the stepson. He's already worried about stepping on Foreign Office toes."
The inspector left the room.
"Go ahead, Ernie. You walked over to take a look at Cherry Trees."
"Yes, Chief. All those high hedges. I can see why they wouldn't be keeping tabs on their neighbours. I went round the house. Cool. What a pong. Without finding anything the locals missed. And it was Mr. Tring taught me to search, so I reckon it's all square and above board with the ladies."
"Good. Now that mysterious vehicle. Miss Hedger told me you'd unravelled the riddle.
I talked to the ladies about it, Chief, this morning, before I went to look at the scene of the crime. Miss Chandler and Mrs. Fletcher witnessed a black saloon driving dangerously last Friday night. It sped past them up Orchard Road and turned into Station Road, without pausing to look for cross-traffic. Miss Chandler didn't catch the letters, but she memorised the numbers, 874, so she could report it if she ever again saw it posing a threat to life and limb.
We already had possible letters, didn't we?
That's right, Chief. BH874. Made it easy for the county to look it up. It's a Jowett. As for the owner, they confirmed what Miss Sutcliffe guessed. It's Vaughan's.
Vaughan's? No surprise, really. He's known to have been hanging about cherry trees, first to sell it, then to try for news of Mrs. Gray.
D.C. Pennycook talked to some of the neighbours again and managed to get a bit more out of them than they'd offered to the uniformed officers.
Well done.
Alec's nod of approbation turned the young detective's ears bright red. Ernie Piper, not so many years his senior, but much more experienced, resumed his report. Several of them had noticed the car parked outside cherry trees for extended periods, longer than the business of selling the house would account for. One had seen it a couple of times, in the evening, driving up the street, slowing in front of the house, then dashing on. She thought it was driven by a woman. Right, Pennycook?
That's it, Sarge. She was pretty certain.
The Jowett is actually registered to Myra Vaughan, Chief, not her husband.
Is it indeed? What, if anything, do we know about her?
Only what Mr. Underwood found out from Vaughan's employer, Mr. Langridge. She's older than he is, and she's the one with the money. The car is available to Vaughan when needed to show a property to a client, which is not often, as most of their business is in High Wycombe. Mr. Langridge hasn't met her, though he hired Vaughan on the recommendation of her brother, a highly respected local accountant.
That would be the partner in Miss Chandler's firm, correct? What's his name?
Ernie, as always, had the information at his fingertips, or rather, on the tip of his tongue, as he didn't have to consult the notes in front of him. Mr. Spencer, of Spencer, Mott and Davis. Davis is the partner Miss Chandler answers to.
So the inspector talked to Davis?
Yes, Chief. You're getting ahead of me.
Sorry. Do it your way, or we might miss out something vital.
D.I. Underwood asked Mr. Langridge whether Vaughan was a satisfactory employee. Langridge said, on the whole, yes. Mr. Underwood thought he was being evasive and pressed a bit, but he wouldn't say any more except that Vaughan is very good at hooking buyers and tenants, which is, after all, their business.
What sort?
Alec paused as the inspector returned.
I got through right away, he grumbled, only to find Mr. Parry's gone to a meeting in Aylesbury. At least he can't say I didn't try. What were you asking?
Piper said you thought Langridge wasn't telling the whole story about Vaughan. I wondered what kind of man he is.
Hail fellow well met. I should think he was good at the business in his time. But he's now too stout to budge from behind his desk without much huffing and puffing. In fact, while I was there, his secretary brought in a paper that urgently needed signing, and simply leaning far enough forward to put his name to it was a hard job of work.
Langridge sounded like an easy job for Tom Tring, Alec thought. He and his missus could go in with vague inquiries about looking for a place in the country and move on to the shortcomings of the younger generation.
He refused to explain his reservations about Vaughan.
I didn't push it. We can always go back. But as it happens, I got a clue to Vaughan's feelings at Miss Chandler's firm. I talked to her boss, Mr. Davis. He speaks very highly of her, incidentally. They wouldn't have hired her if she hadn't had an excellent reference from the partner in Yorkshire who encouraged her to qualify as an accountant.
Did Davis say why her previous boss didn't keep her on?
He couldn't talk his partner into it, partly because she'd started there in a lowly position, so he didn't think she'd have the authority. Partly just what Davis described as typical northern stick-in-the-muddishness, just as the ladies told us. Mind you, I gather Davis had trouble with his own partners, but he persuaded them it was the forward-looking, go-ahead way to get a march on their competitors. Full of clichés, our Mr. Davis.
Alec and Annie Piper laughed. Pennycook ventured a tentative smile.
And what did he have to say about Vaughan?
Alec asked. Nothing direct, though I was pretty direct with him, given Miss Chandler's hints of a connection. He admitted that Langridge is a client, who's presently having his books audited. He wouldn't confirm that Miss Chandler is handling the audit, nor that Langridge requested the audit, because he suspects the books have been cooked.
They're trying to keep Vaughan in the dark, Ernie suggested.
That's how it looks to me, Underwood agreed. Maybe trying to keep his wife's brother in the dark as well. Assuming he's been cooking up the books, could Mrs. Gray have found out?
You're thinking blackmail,
Alec suggested.
Conceivable, though I can't imagine how she'd have found out.
It might have been obvious, Chief, from what he said when they talked about the price of the house. I don't know how it'd work, but if he's skimming a bit off the top, Miss Chandler's the one to ask.
If she'll answer, I'm more inclined to consider an affair gone wrong. You haven't interviewed him yet, I take it, Inspector.
No, sir. His work is the perfect excuse to keep him out of our way. His wife was out too when I called at their house. I left a note with the maid, setting an appointment for 6 this evening. I hope you'll join me, unless you'd rather do it yourself.
No, the two of us should impress him with the necessity of cooperation. What about Mrs. Vaughan? We'll need to talk to her as well.
I hope she'll be there. If not, we'll have to catch her tomorrow. But if he doesn't turn up, we'll find him one way or another and bring him into the station. We need to have a chat with Mr. Vaughan.
Good enough. Which leaves Cartwright?
How about all 4 of us waiting at the school gate when the children get out?
Underwood grinned.
I don't mind giving the slimy bastard a bit of a scare.
It's an attractive thought,
Alec considered.
But on the whole, better not. We don't want all the children hanging about asking questions. If we lurk behind the yews in the graveyard, we can watch the school until they have left, and then go in.
25. Daisy hurried along Orchard Road through the rain. By the time she reached Cherry Trees, it was coming down hard, with no signs of letting up. At the gate, an elderly Bobby was buttoning his cape. "Is Miss Sutcliffe in, officer?"
"Are you press?"
he countered. "A reporter? No, a friend."
"They told me to watch out for girl reporters. Ho! I never seen such a thing."
"Have you had many reporters turn up?"
"Yesterday. Just the one today. Not much interest in a body in a cellar since Dolores Wendover, the actress, shot that lord yesterday."
"Good heavens. What lord? I've been avoiding the newspapers."
"Can't rightly remember the name, madam, but I dare say he deserved it. Anyways, if it keeps them news hands away from here, I'm right grateful to Miss Wendover.
You have a point, Daisy agreed. Her ankles were getting wet. I hope you don't have to stand out in the rain much longer. She stepped forward and, with a gloomy mutter about Sergeant Harris, he moved aside to let her through the gate. Isabel couldn't possibly be gardening in this downpour. Daisy hoped the house had been disinfected enough to be bearable by now. She rang the bell. From the open kitchen window to her right came Isabel's voice.
Daisy, just a minute. It's locked, and I'm just scrubbing the soil out of my fingernails.
Weeding? That's right. A minute later, the door opened. Daisy couldn't restrain herself. She sniffed as she stepped across the threshold.
Sorry, that's rude, but it's much better, isn't it?
I'm glad to hear it. I wasn't sure if it was wishful thinking.
It's more disinfectant than anything else. Better enough for a cup of tea if we go into the sitting room and close the door?
Definitely. Can I help?
No. Go and sit down. I already put the kettle on. It won't take a moment.
Only 5 days had passed. 4, if one didn't count Friday itself, since last time Isabel had gone to make tea while Daisy waited in the sitting room. She chose the same chair by the fireplace. No fire burned in the grate now, though the room was chilly. She kept her coat and hat on. Isabel still wore her gardening jacket and a woolly hat when she came in with tea and biscuits.
I think they're all right, she said doubtfully. They were in a tin with a tight lid, but don't eat any if you're suspicious. I'll light the fire.
Not just for me.
It'll help freshen the air. Besides, we'll probably move back in this evening. The hotel's getting a bit expensive.
Will Inspector Underwood let you?
Yes. He popped into the Saracen's Head at lunchtime to tell me we can come home as soon as we're ready.
I don't think he really suspects us. Do you?
I don't think so.
You three have no motive. Of course, the police don't have to prove motive.
But without at least the shadow of one, they have to have more incontrovertible evidence than they're ever going to find in this case. I've seen no signs that any of you are under suspicion.
That's a relief. That, and getting the cleaning done. I thought I'd do some baking this afternoon. It always makes the house smell good.
Good idea. It's really not bad, though. You must have picked good workers.
A couple of ex-soldiers who just can't settle to a steady job, as Mrs. Barnes said. One of them gets bad spells, and the other can't cope without his pal.
Poor chaps.
They even dug out the floor a couple of inches deep to get rid of... It's chalk, you know. Absorbent. I'll have to put down paving stones to fill the space, or I'll keep tripping over the edge. They said they'd try to come back tomorrow to help, but not to count on it. I gave them the best letters of reference I honestly could.
That reminds me. Did Mrs. Hedger give you a written recommendation from Mrs. Gray?
No, as a matter of fact. I could see how well she'd been keeping up, with no one telling her what to do. Also, frankly, I didn't care to ask for one. You know what she's like.
That reminds me. I must go and pick up the post.
The police wouldn't let the postman deliver yesterday, and the post office said they'd hold everything for us until they heard otherwise.
Why do you ask?
Because if Mrs. Hedger had a signed and dated letter, the police would know Mrs. Gray was still alive then, and in England.
They still don't know when she died?
Not as far as I know. They aren't even 100% sure it's her, the last I heard. 99.5%. But she could be living the gay life in France. Surely they must have asked Mrs. Hedger when she left. I presume so.